Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Studying Media Critically, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm your host, Gummo Clare, and today I'm joined by Marianne Franklin, who's Professor of Global Media and Politics in the Department of Media, Communications and Cultural Studies at Goldsmiths, University of London. We're discussing her book, Sampling Politics, Music and the Geocultural, which was published in 2021. Welcome to the show, Marianne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So just to start off with, could you tell us a little bit about your path into academia and kind of what drew you to write this?
My path into academia, well, have you got all night? a zigzag path in and around, up and down. But eventually I settled and I stayed. That's the short version.
And so, because I know you've written kind of quite broadly before, what kind of drew you specifically to this kind of subject matter?
Well, I studied music and then I left academia for the first time. And then I came back and I entered international relations and politics. So music kind of sort of didn't seem like an academic pursuit. But I've always been interested in the links between politics and culture, however defined, and particularly the performing arts and sonic cultures, but never thought of it as an academic pursuit until 2005, where I put together an edited volume called Resounding International Relations on Music, Culture and Politics. And that book pretty much set me on this path, though I did a couple of others in between, and I do a lot of work about internet policy making, stuff like that, because I've always been interested with the digital and its mediation and elucidation and enabling and all the other kinds of weird, wonderful things that these technologies have allowed us to do, but particularly the performing arts and music in particular. So it was just a matter of time before I turned a corner again and came back to sort of where I started, but in a different place. And sampling politics is the outcome of a few years of that work alongside everything else.
So this book is kind of a really ambitious attempt, I think, to explicitly kind of read geopolitics from music as music and tracing a number of kind of famous samples and examples of musical borrowing and their trajectories through process of citation and back to the original versions themselves. Did your decision to kind of take this approach come from any frustrations with existing culturally formed analyses of music and politics? And then also, how did you go about selecting the samples that you deal with in the book?
Well, yes, a lot of frustration, because I think we work in literary media. Our media, no matter how audiovisual it is still very much the written word. And much as I have a lot of respect for lyrics, who doesn't? All meaning, particularly political or whatever you might define, was being distilled from lyrics only, with an occasional wave of the hand at the musicality, however defined again, because I define that, as you can imagine, quite broadly. And particularly as these ideas entered politics departments, partly through the Resounding International Relations volume, people were still fixated on lyrics only, or fan cultures, audiences, and that's all really important work. I'm not dissing it as such, but it's only part of the story. So that was the disciplinary frame in which I set myself for this particular study, which began very back in Resounding International Relations, as I realized we were just doing literary analysis, basically, when talking about music. So reducing music to the literary, which I think is problematic.
And so there's a really, really wide range of kind of musics that you take on across the chapters. And so one, you analyze one group of sounds using kind of raga theory derived from Indian classical music. And another one, you like follow the network of makams, which underpin a lot of Arabic and Levantine music. And then elsewhere, you know, we've got 20th century post-war European avant-garde and hip hop. And you use theoretical approaches derived from each music's own kind of emic tradition, which feels like quite a big undertaking. So could you tell us a little bit about the work involved in theorizing these kind of sets of music?
Well, I broke every rule that I try and help my students with by A, having 5 case studies instead of 1, maximum 2. Perhaps you can get away with 3. And then I still whittled those down. And secondly, by being absolutely ridiculously ambitious. But I was following the music. I was following the sample, and that took me on the places that I've hoped the reader has followed me into and out of through my own learning, my own relearning, and also the extraordinary conversations I've had with practitioners during the writing of the book and the research. And of course, since the conversations are still continuing, I mean, I've been corrected or nuanced or refined by at least 2 other people for 2 specific chapters. And it's an open-ended book, even though it seems like everything's completed and finished as we see these artifacts. So it was ridiculously ambitious. A COVID kind of helped, maybe. I take your point. And thank you for your summary. I couldn't do better than you've just done. And yes, you did have to go into a lot of theory, music theory, which in itself is still a disputed terrain, even in terms of Arabic music, music of the Arabic world, or even within classical Indian raga, and also rap and hip hop. So I had to respect not just the musicalities, but the intersectional race, gender, class, religious or non-religious traditions from which they emerged over long periods of time as well. So I learned a heap. It was just amazing. It was extraordinary. It made my music training look pretty meager, actually.
But I think something that's quite impressive is you managed to express a lot of this stuff, which over such a big kind of, you know, sonic and geographic span, in a way that's you can follow even if you haven't got kind of really strong musicological chops or whatever. So I did really enjoy the fact that it wasn't impenetrable.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. That was actually the secret objective number 5, which I didn't actually write in too much, because then you hoist yourself on your own petard. But thank you.
So, like, turning to the chapters one by one, you start in a really interesting place with John Cage's kind of infamous silent piece, 4 minutes 33. So what does this work kind of offer us for thinking about sampling and or as politics? And what have kind of subsequent critical commentaries or analysts perhaps got a bit wrong about the political potentials of acousmatics as played out in performances of 4:33?
Oh, that's a really great question. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much sort of peel things to the essence. And to think about, you know, what is sampling, you know, taking from where and what. So I'm kind of appropriating Cage, even though he's actually a very early sampler himself. Back in the 50s, late 40s, he was doing what we call sampling, even rap and hip-hop style kind of stuff. So I was trying to strip it down to its essence, and this chapter came from me performing 4:33 and discovering how difficult it is to actually bring off, even though in music departments it gets a bit poo-pooed, but it is actually a very difficult piece to bring off. And I loved its kind of up you attitude that still is as fresh as ever 70 years later, from 52, what are we now, 70 years ago actually. So that was a place to start, and to really start thinking about what sound is or is not, and obviously to engage with sound theorists and the idea of what is music or not music, to get out of that kind of classical popular frame that has it be a, you know, 12-bar blues and, you know, a succession of clearly organized, non-problematic chord progressions and that sort of thing. And I think John Cage belongs to a generation of men and women, not just in the States, but also in Asia Pacific, and obviously in Europe, who really wanted to challenge those presumptions about the quality of sound and who organizes it in what way. Though they themselves have become establishment, of obviously, since. So that's my answer to the Cage question. You had another one, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of thinking about how some of the receptions of 433, both kind of contemporaneous with John Cage, but then subsequently maybe have overlooked some of the interesting political potentials or some of the questions raised by Cage's work.
Well, I think you're right. It's double-edged because certainly those scholars who've engaged with 433 from the point of view of its either cultural politics, obviously he's a product of Cold War America. His work, as was the case with many of its contemporaries, was deployed, secretly funded by the CIA to supposedly project this idea of anything goes and this equals freedom, equals democracy, vis-a-vis this tightly controlled forms of art and culture in the Soviet Union. So that was obvious kind of politics in a way. But also because silence itself, however, you know, however we might want to think of it or experience it, is both politically, has a politically empowering motivation, but also an oppressive motivation. To silence someone is to, like it says, to stop them speaking or prevent them from articulating or having a voice. But remaining silent is also, I think it's some amendment, isn't it, in the American Constitution. But remaining silent is also dangerous. In British history, people have lost their heads, as we know, by being silent, certainly during the religious wars and a few centuries ago. So silence itself is a quality, and many a great poet and playwright has waxed lyrical about so-called silence. And I think Cage understood this. It was also a bit of a gimmick, but it's an incredibly effective one. And if you see it performed and you're in an audience when it's being performed by somebody else, the challenge is always there. A, can you sit still long enough? B, what are the feelings that you notice as you notice that, you know, 2 minutes is a very long time to sort of do nothing and that sort of thing. So the politics there are not straightforward. And I think that's why it's such a powerful way to start, to challenge our assumptions of what is or is not political for a start and what is or is not music as organized sound. And there, I think Cage was a very important player in those debates. It's got to start somewhere. The 52, halfway through the 20th century, it was kind of convenient as well.
Also, one thing I really liked is how you kind of put it in dialogue with Christopher Small, and because the idea that a performance of 433 brings the importance of relationships and participation so strongly to the foreground in the experience of musicking. And it's, again, it was just a really interesting place to start, I suppose, with a theory like musicking, which now is has become so kind of expansive and used so widely. I kind of was a really interesting reframing for me anyway of that.
But what I wanted to add was just how many times the idea of 433 has been in itself sampled, you know, and I cite some of the bands like Radiohead, Granddaddy, even the avant-gardists like Stockhausen, of course, deliberately make that reference. So it's an incredibly influential piece because silence or non-sound is also an crucial part of any sonic or musical composition as well. And he was just flipping the telescope, really, or flipping the speaker scope. I'm trying to use sonic reference as well because the visual ones are so strong. So, yeah, I think in that sense it was the most – it was a challenging chapter because there's an enormous literature about John Cage, including his own literature about himself and his work, because he was also an author of some distinction. So, yes, it was a good place to start, and I think – given what we've all been through with lockdown, I think 433 still remains quite powerful, however you want to interpret it. But politically, it's complicated.
I think actually that idea of dealing with all the kind of meta commentary that someone like John Cage provides, you know, that's also something you mentioned. Stockhausen does something similar, but which is notable by its absence with some of the kind of global South performers who you cite, whose opportunities to provide meta commentary on their own work are far more muted. So I wonder if we'll come back to that actually. And so then in the next chapter, you talk about Asian Dub Foundation and specifically their tunes Fortress Europe and Rebel Warrior. Could you tell us a bit about this group and the kind of complex post and decolonial politics of their music and the Asian underground scene that they came from?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to acknowledge Oniruta Das's input into this chapter and the book generally. Oniruta is just doing some incredibly interesting thinking and creating of his own about, you know, frequencies, political frequencies, along with other colleagues. So he has worked within Asian Dove Foundation, and now he's gone solo. And of course, those two tracks are really, really established tracks from their very, very early output. So when I began the book many years ago proper, Fortress Europe had gone a little bit out of fashion. It came out in 2002. I did have my doubts, but of course, since we've had these new issues around immigration and anti-immigration rhetoric and the use of Frontex from the European Union point of view, border controls, there the lyrics do start to really become quite prescient. But it was a chance for me to really look at a group that has been out there right from the start saying we are political about the way we make music. And we make music in such a way that sounds our politics. And they've been on record ever since they began in this level. And it isn't just because they're dub or Asian dub, or that's really important and there's been really good stuff written about that in their heyday. I really wanted to get into the formal qualities of those tracks, particularly Fortress Europe, and just figure out, as I hope I've shown in the chapter, just how they do actually musically, formally and sonically and in their production values, do something more than a track that talks about border guards and xenophobia, which, because lyrics are obviously political, I mean, that's a no-brainer. So from an analytical point of view, where do you go from there? Fortunately, music there provide lots and lots of material. So I had to do some old school musicological analysis there. And it was really interesting. I discovered quite a lot.
And I wondered if you could try, I mean, it's going to be quite challenging, but I wondered if you could try and do a bit of explanation of some of the analysis and some of the kind of genealogies you kind of trace by following specifically the vocal hook from Fortress Europe.
That's probably where I'm stretching things a little bit. I realized that I needed to look at some of the theories about musical borrowing. Because sampling is a form of borrowing. And that opening line, even though it's ascending, and the line I say it's so-called borrowing from is descending, the vocalist in question understands, just as Asian Dove Foundation understands their Bollywood references and their classical music references. So Sonia Mehta knows what she's doing in that vocal. And Onirutta also confirmed how important the vocal is for conveying a sense of anguish and urgency. So I started to explore the movie that I claim and others have sensed that she's riffing off, whether she knew it or not. Strictly speaking, maybe I've got it completely wrong. But it was really, really interesting to get into this really old movie called Amrapali and discover this particular personage as an historical figure and all the very interesting highways and byways in terms of gender, nation, popular movie music in the Indian tradition and the classical raga that, of course, are embedded in Asian Dove Foundation's music making, because they also draw on their parents' record and video collections, which they say themselves, but reconfirmed by Onirutta. So I felt that as a listener, if we wanted to get past the obvious politics of the lyrics, we need to understand the codes by which a South Asian performer who's, you know, listened to classical and popular Indian music or South Indian, North Indian, how they actually just absorb these tropes and make them work in their own music. And how, unless we take the time as non-experts or not socialized in these musical forms, how much we miss. So I'm offering, I hope, some new dimensions to a listener, because I think Fortress Europe is a very tightly organized track, really, really shows its dub reggae references, but also really understands the sources from which it's pulling and troubling them as well, and not putting up with any idea that there's a rigid classical ideal in Indian classical music, because that's strict as Western classical theory is, certainly the way you're taught. So that's how I did it. And I just sat down, listened to the track a lot, and divided it up into bars, and then figured out when the changes came, when the vocals entered, you know, and discovered how even it was, even-handed. So it's allowing equal airtime, airplay structurally in the track to the female vocal, the dub vocal that comes in, and their own layering techniques, which is, of course, is a feature of sampling in digital terms.
And so then in the following chapter, we kind of move in a very different direction sonically and to a number of different debates as well. And it's a kind of a fascinating discussion of the quite infamous Brian Eno and David Byrne album, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and some of the music that it samples. So I wondered if you could start by explaining some of the kind of key controversies that have emerged and continue to dog this record.
Well, basically, it represents, particularly these days, as the debate heats up, cultural appropriation at its worst, but also in terms of aesthetically or musically, a very, very early pioneering form of analog sampling in the studio at its best. And so it's that tension once again. Eno and Byrne did get, you know, officially clearance, but the real controversy goes back before Byrne and Eno sample from a compilation record. The compilation record is a compilation of field recordings that was part of a Horniman Museum, which is in the south of London, not far from Goldsmiths, contribution to this huge World of Islam festival. Which in itself is a book worthy. And as you may have noticed, this is the longest chapter and enormously complex and multi-level issues around ownership, control, access, consent, and gender. Because the person whose voice and performance is constantly written out of all the outrage from journalists and other musicians about Eno and Byrne is Dunya Yunus herself. And that's scandalous, because if we're going to be outraged about cultural appropriation of a vocal line, this wasn't the only vocal line that Eno and Byrne sampled from. They got into trouble with some of the American samples. It's because it's constantly, this is where my gender kind of politics came through for me. It's constantly men telling us about music, mansplaining their way through the music. And Eunice's voice and her performance was completely silenced. So back to Cage. So here, Johnny Farage became an enormous well of knowledge for me. And he and I are still discussing this particular track, because to him, Abu Zuluf, which is the title given to the sampled performance, you know, it's like Danny Boy is to many of us. You know, if somebody starts singing Danny Boy in a pub, everybody goes, oh, you know. The same effect is how Abu Zuluf comes across to many audiences in the whole Levantine region. Not just the maqam, the scale it uses, but the actual specifics of it. So, and it's now identified with Lebanon. So there's so many, it's so easy, you can't just point the finger at one particular quote-unquote culprit. And for me, the problem was, I love My Life in the Bush of Ghosts as an album. I've got it on vinyl, man. And I mean, what do you do when you learn something about a record and you realize that it's based on a form of pilfering that could have been done another way? And there's no point saying it was the 70s, we didn't know any better. Because the field recordings themselves are problematic. I've seen the original records. I've been to the Scottish National Archives, where Gene Jenkins' personal archives are. And there's a whole story there about which recordings ended up in these six vinyl, box set. That in itself is problematic in terms of ethnomusicology. And that debate's been thrashed out somewhat in other areas. So, and then I realized I knew nothing about maqam based music. So it's very complicated, that chapter. And I wanted to see how Eno and Byrne themselves used the sample musically without judgment, and then judge them. I mean, I'm sounding a bit facetious, but I mean, musically, they are doing something very, very interesting with all the tracks. But then I got more and more troubled as I got deeper into how they put each track together. And they also use a track from a commercial recording. And then, you know, we have lots of Eno and Byrne waxing on about this album after the fact. Lots and lots of them talking about this album, but they seem blissfully unaware of the provenance and the sonic cultures of the tracks they use. And I find some of their pronouncements surprisingly specious, actually. But I haven't thrown out my copy of My Life in the Bush Ghosts. I do think it has its place in the history of studio sampling. And I know that they've been held to account on a number of levels. And I just wanted to reconstruct the history of the field recordings from which they took, the World of Islam Festival itself, and also this complete misappreciation of the track. The way it got represented as Islamic, as Muslim, when in fact it's a secular vocal line, sung by a Christian vocalist. So there we have it. So the whole issue about cultural appropriation, how close it becomes to racial stereotyping. And I think music journalists for me became my bête noire in this chapter. But and then I caught myself as well. We all just sort of find ourselves reiterating the same mistake, which when we get to the next chapter also came to the fore. So, yeah, it was a challenging chapter, but, yeah, and Johnny Farage, once again, I want to acknowledge his input, and also I also want to acknowledge Dunya Yunis and her daughter, Rayana, who allowed me to ask them questions about something that's a very long time ago and has been the source of some distress, to the point that the original recording in the Olsen Archives in Denmark, where I did go as well to Copenhagen, has been closed. Because Eunice and her family are sick and tired of having Westerners coming along and listening to what was in fact a private recording.
The way that you unpick it all, for one thing, reveals exactly what a ethical minefield the whole thing is, and in such a way that, you know, cultural appropriation as a kind of label for it doesn't even scratch the surface, I think, which is it's so interesting. And it, as you say, it's very complicated, and I would urge listeners to read it, because we're not going to be able to kind of touch the sides of this chapter, I don't think. But one thing I did want to ask specifically that I found fascinating, thinking about the kind of macro politics of it all, was you have a really fascinating section on this Vision of Islam festival in which the track was first kind of, I guess, entered into circulation. And you talk about how this slightly homogenizing understanding of Islamic music and history plays a role here. And that's a reflection of specific kind of conjunctural forces and geopolitical forces in the late 1970s. So I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, well, of course, actually, this is going to be my next book, I think, because I think in the archives, the Foreign Office, the British government was keeping their ears very close to the ground with this festival. So it in itself is a product of the 70s. You know, Iran before the revolution, Iran after the revolution, the oil crisis and all the rest. And it's the first moment, I think, where we have this so-called, as Huntington would try and tell us, so-called clash of civilizations. But the World of Islam Festival has come under a lot of criticism by Muslim scholars in particular, because it's a very particular branding. And music, so-called, in Islam itself has a complicated relationship, and in some schools of Islam, music isn't recognized or permitted. And in others, like the Sufi tradition, of course, it's a very important aspect of worship and ritual. But the World of Islam Festival, I discovered, was a very, very important part of the story. It's also how British listeners through the BBC were introduced to music of the Arabic world, but being presented as music of the Islamic world, and they're not the same thing. And that's where Eno, I'm pretty sure, heard for the first time the recitation from the Quran that was on the original pressing of it, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and then was removed because it was objected to, and where he would, because Jean Jenkins herself was on BBC, and I was very lucky to find some of the archives and hear her playing some tracks. As an ethnomusicologist, she certainly knew what she was talking about. But the World of Islam Festival itself was a form of branding, a form of positioning about so-called Islam and culture. And we've all forgotten about it. Strangely enough, my mother remembered it, of all things. She said, oh, I remember that. So it went right through the Commonwealth. So it in itself is worthy of more study.
That whole chapter, even though you do a really good job and you cover so much ground, I came away from it with so many more questions to see, you know, where's next. So yeah, that comes through very strongly. And then in the next chapter, we're in a different place again, and we're looking at Karlheinz Stockhausen's piece Hymnen, I think it's pronounced.
That's right, yes.
A very lengthy piece of electroacoustic music from the 1960s, where he extracts from and manipulates hundreds of different national anthems. Could you tell us a bit more about the kind of work that Stockhausen and his team did to construct this piece?
Well, he basically got a recording of the national anthems from UNESCO, and then he played with them. And because he had all the equipment he could possibly dream of, he had his own studio equipped by the South German Radio Broadcasting Corporation. And he actually, you know, pioneered some of the equipment that we all use, or people use now in digital form. And he was experimenting a lot with sonnet manipulation at the time. And this is before he went digital himself. So this is very analog, twiddling of dials, you know, pressing buttons on tape machines, if any listeners remember those. Just like Brian Eno and David Byrne did, they were sellotaping bits of tape together. And he wanted to see what he could do technologically to these, what he called very familiar, almost cliche pieces of music. But of course, some of them aren't cliche. Some of them are part of the classical canon that have been taken on as national anthems. And so that too needed listening and considering on its own musical sonic terms. But the minute I started to look at some of the anthems that he used and some of the critiques about it being a Eurocentric piece of cosmopolitan horseshit, I would like to beg to differ with those listeners. I think Stockhausen is a very, very erudite, intelligent, super intelligent scholar and artist. And this is an example of research-based composition. So he was playing with, you know, the Cold War split. He's the same generation as Cage, but younger. You know, he was furious with the Soviet Union because they denounced his music as, you know, decadent in similar ways. The Nazis had denounced art. He's a product of the First and Second World War. He's a product of the Nazi terror in terms of what happened to his mother. And so there's so much in here of a personal nature, which he doesn't hide. But he also plays with the national anthems of not only what was then East Germany and West Germany, but he also sneaks in the short-lived Nazi national anthem, which got him into a lot of trouble. So Hymn in itself is an experiment in electroacoustic sonic manipulation before the digital took over. But I think for me, as I've argued, it's an act of remembering. And that to me was the big discovery as I listened more closely to the music and was able to follow it on his score. And this is a point I must bring up. Most, you know, traditional composers write a score and then it gets performed. In this case, he made the piece and afterwards he transcribed it into traditional classical scoring. So he sat down with a stopwatch and wrote down what he heard of a piece he'd made. So he flipped the order. But the score is a very, very important resource for spotting which national anthem comes in where, you know, two from Ethiopia, Afghanistan, strange enough, because it didn't have one when the Taliban were in power the first time. And so there's a lot there on an archival nature. Sadly, I couldn't get down to Curtin, where the Stockhausen archives reside. But if I had, I probably would have never finished the book. because it's such a rich archive in itself. And it hasn't been appreciated in the UK, this piece. Some of the reviews, particularly shortly after 2001, 9/11, Stockhausen made a quip, and that got him into hot water. And it's also like Fortress Europe. It's a piece that's come and gone with the times, and I think it's back, just like Fortress Europe, because we're living in a redux of some of the tensions that Stockhausen was trying to question, actually, through what he was doing. And also, he was just playing. There's a lot of ludic fun in Stockhausen's work, but it's a very powerful piece. If you've got a 3-hour train journey, it takes 2.5 hours, highly recommended. And feel free to fall asleep because it'll wake you up at some point.
Oh yeah, it's less likely to be as soporific as, for example, a lot of the national anthems I know anyway.
Well, of course, you know, that chapter I had to bring in, of course, Miles Davis and then Jimi Hendrix, because we know when national anthems are played around with, quote unquote, the forces of cultural control get upset. And musicians have been put in prison, like visual artists, for doing the wrong thing. So just as Hendrix got into trouble with his version of the American national anthem, I think Stockhausen's chopping up and reversing and playing around with quote-unquote sacred national anthems, including God Save the Queen, also was considered irreverent in some quarters. So he was also troubling that kind of sanctity that is completely constructed and complete imaginary, but has a force of military and police and forces of order behind it.
One interesting facet of that chapter, as you kind of touched on there as well, is the exchange. So it's not just about borrowing on Stockhausen's part, but you kind of discuss and interrogate ideas of exchange between Stockhausen and his wing of the avant-garde and more experimental popular and jazz forms in the 60s and onwards. I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
When we come to, you know, the crossover between so-called popular jazz and classical canons, this is why Miles Davis is a very important figure, because he was trained at the Juilliard School of Music. Conversely, Stockhausen was a jazz pianist when he was young. That's how he earned his living. So these false divisions, they're also part of the kind of marketing machine that has journalists talking about classical music on one side or pop music on the other side. Absolute nonsense. And also the issue around race, the fact that African-American composers also include the classical canon. And the admiration, of course, that bands like the Beatles, Miles Davis himself held for Stockhausen as well, including Björk. She is a complete Stockhausen fangirl. So all those crossovers are there, they're happening. And yet in our writing, in our reading, as interested listeners or scholars, we don't see the crossovers in the writing. So in that sense, I took liberties perhaps towards the end of that chapter to delve into Miles Davis, Frank Zappa, and Jimi Hendrix, and also to remind us that the one anthem that Stockhausen doesn't sample from is the Black National Anthem. And I'd like to thank one of my students, Madison Williams, for pointing that out. Now, the Black National Anthem doesn't actually feature in Stockhausen's repertoire of anthems, even though it's 100 years old, if not older. So lots to be thought about there. And it's also a piece that just keeps surprising you every time you hear it. I played it actually to a Nigerian musician the other day on the train, just by chance, who is a juju exponent. So he plays a very different kind of music. And so I played him Africa Center, and I saw the look on his face. He wasn't too sure about what he was hearing, because he was hearing, you know, the newly independent national anthems of the newly decolonized African states in the 60s being chopped up. And of course, it's coming from a tradition that he doesn't practice himself. So it's an amazing piece and doesn't always make you feel comfortable. I do admit that that's true, even though I'm much more familiar with it now. And it's also hard on the ears because it goes to the top range of frequencies, which are up there with tinnitus and right down to the deep dub bass that Oniruta talks about as political. So fine piece of experimentation, a very poignant piece of remembering, and a hugely important historical document in sonic form.
And then in your final chapter, you turn to what I guess many people will think of as the primary site of sample culture in music, which is rap and hip hop. And here you draw on Henry Louis Gates's theory of signifying as a way to think about the kind of complex web of intertextual referencing in hip hop. So could you maybe give a little bit of a primer on this theory and then how you apply it to Gil Scott-Heron's piece, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised?
Okay, well, this is the idea of, Africa / African-American cultures of signifying, of paying homage, of practices that jazz pianists and jazz musicians were doing long before the digital and the scratching techniques brought, through hip hop and rap brought this to the world stage. And signifying is a form of respect, just as we learn from musical borrowing and its history. You take the sound or a phrase or a lick and you interpolate it, and you presume that your audience knows that you've interpolated this particular moment. So it's based on a mutual understanding of what the source was in the first place. And that mutual understanding, of course, is much larger than just the one listener and the musician. So signifying, Henry Gates takes it from literary theory, and there's some very extraordinarily important theories in African and Black studies about the cultural relationships and conversations that go on that are specifically related to African-American Black politics, but also how they might link back to the continent of Africa, and of course Afro-Caribbean sounds. So in that sense, one had to think about if rap and hip-hop are the site of what we think in the West as sampling. We have to remember that it too didn't just come from nowhere. It became a huge huge hit because the music industry got a hold of it, and you know, the rest is history. But the idea of borrowing and signifying and doing it in ways that are coded that the communities understand, but those who are not from those communities may not get. So there's a very complicated gender sexuality trope in here, which is why I looked at Sarah Jones, particularly her respectful dissing of Gil Scott Heron's signature piece, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, because being censored on public radio because you use explicit terms for sexuality. Now we see, you know, Cardi B and, you know, female rap and hip hop stars being very, very explicit. It's a lot more permissible and permitted these days. But back in the 90s, when Sarah Jones turned the signifying back on Scott Heron's kind of masculine idioms, she got promptly taken off the airwaves. So that was part of that story. But the theories of signifying is very, very important for understanding why hip-hop and rap lyrics and the actual content itself is not straightforward, explicit. You can't take a positivist approach to it. You can't just say she said something sexually explicit, therefore that's what she meant. She could be meaning something else entirely. And that's what Gates really, really unpacks, along with other scholars, that it's not about literal meaning. It's coded, like all language is coded. And that's why when you talk about politics and music through only the lyrics, you miss half the story because of metaphor, irony, humour. And then the tricky part here is, of course, when the music industry, who own all the copyright, then start to see a monetized value in taking artists to court, or artists take other artists to court. So a lot of stuff about sampling in the rap and hip-hop eras, particularly in the 80s and 90s, it gets, you know, wrapped up in the whole issues around litigation. So you really had to think about it as the point of view of signifying as within African-American communities, as music making before, during, and since rap and hip-hop took off as a global market, but also the gender, sex, gender, sexual politics within rap and hip-hop, particularly for Black African-American women and in the Black political movement that we're now seeing, where they're saying, hang on a minute, we don't want to have your bombastic wrapped in plastic, that sort of thing. We can do it just as well. People like Missy Elliott have been absolute trailblazers in that respect. So lots to learn there as well. Scott Heron himself didn't like The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. It wasn't his favorite track. But it's certainly a life-changing track if you hear it at any age. So, and also because he's been sampled so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and how he in the end, under the new regime of acknowledging quite explicitly where your sample's from and getting permission, if not paying. So in his final album, we see him sampling from Kanye West. So the circle is rounded in some kind of way.
I think your reflections on Gil Scott Heron's kind of slightly uneasy relationship with both hip hop, being seen as a godfather of hip hop, but also with that track, really shows quite powerfully the like really real ambivalence of sampling and borrowing as a force of decontextualization. Because I think the Revolution Will Not Be Televised, you know, he didn't want that to become a cipher for his entire kind of body of work, which was more complicated than that. But its mobility, by virtue of, you know, borrowing and circulation, it underpins so much of its power, and then so much of its reinterpretation and the critiques that you cite afterwards. And so I think it sits so nicely as a kind of indication of, yeah, the real, really like ambivalent power and politics of internal to sampling and of sampling as a form of politics. At the end of the book, I thought it really kind of rounded off so much of the earlier arguments, I think.
Yes, I think so too. And I think because I wanted to get out of this kind of chronological trap, where you start with A and end at Z, as if this is some kind of explanatory paradigm in itself, because, you know, all musicians and artists are referring backwards, forwards, and onwards. And you see, the thing is, there's some very important work being done about rap and hip-hop as music, as sonics. We all know it's about rhythm. So I really sat down and did a musicological analysis in my limited way of why it was not just the words, because it's extraordinarily eloquent piece of rapping before it was called rapping, as we know it, but also the way he delivers the words. And not just the jazz backing, that's a very famous lineup that he's got in the version that we know with the more jazzy feel, but just the rhythm. And I really wanted to sort of figure out what it was about his delivery that was so powerful. So it's the, you know, it's a poem. And then Sarah Jones gets it when she says, "This revolution will not be held between these thighs. The revolution will not be televised. This revolution will not be held between these thighs." So there's so much signifying going on here on the literal level, on the sonic level, on, you know, poetic. It's extraordinary, but it is music making. And I think we need to think about rap and hip hop, again, beyond the lyrics, but also the rhythm of the lyrics, the delivery, the production values, particularly with Public Enemy. And they're making extremely important kinds of music that Asian Dub Foundation, of course, pull from and develop in their own way. So once again, it's more than the lyrics, however important the lyrics are.
And that feels kind of more relevant than ever as well, I think, when if you think at some of the kind of preeminent hip-hop artists now, someone like Kendrick Lamar, who is famed as a lyricist, but so much of the kind of interest and the distinctiveness of his performance is about the sonics of his delivery and the way he uses so many different registers, at once going through one song. He might, you know, how he inhabits different characters through a use of different voices, different rhyme schemes. And he raps as a musician. And that's so apparent, I think. And so that kind of analysis is going to become more and more necessary, I think.
Yeah, and also the final thing about the signifying work that people like Gates have done is Gates is still, there's a whole debate, which I only just touch upon, within African-American studies about jazz as the epitome of Black cultural achievement. So there's a certain kind of issue here about hierarchies of values that we see also in thinkers about the Western classical tradition. And there's a whole critique within these debates that, in fact, jazz itself was pretty smutty, quote unquote, in its own time. And this kind of sanitization of jazz, which comes from arguably Winston Marsalis's view with Ken Burns, is being challenged from within African music studies. And this means that rap and hip hop is not that far removed from jazz and popular African-American classical forms, as the literature would like us to suggest. But this is also wrapped up with the whole issue about a minority discriminated, formerly enslaved part of the American populace, whose music actually drives Americans' cultural dominance. So there's another double-edged sword for you. Without African music making, the American music industry wouldn't be anywhere in global terms. And rap and hip hop have just proven it, because now, according to Katz, just like they did in the 60s, the American State Department sees rap and hip hop as a new tool of American diplomacy, cultural diplomacy. Who would have thought? So next thing, we'll see Kendrick Lamar possibly on a diplomatic mission to China next. If not, perhaps he's gone already.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of pleasing neatness, I guess, about that coming full circle in the book about kind of trans-historical trends in music and borrowing across time and space, I suppose, how these things kind of start up again. I mean, as I kind of said at the top, you know, we've only really been able to touch on a tiny slice of what's covered in the book, because it covers huge amounts of music and forms of interpretation and forms of borrowing. So I really would urge anyone listening to check out the full book. But yeah, I mean, I really, really enjoyed it, certainly. You mentioned you were going to maybe build on some of the work you did for the chapter on My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. Is that what you're working on next, or is there anything else kind of coming down?
Well, I'm working on, not quite what I'm working on next. I'm now working on, I'm somewhat delayed because this book we talked about today did take longer than intended. I'm working on what I affectionately call my Punk Chicks book, which is coming out with transcript, if all goes well. Hopefully next year, and that's on Change the Record, Punk Women Music Politics. So I'm looking at all these memoirs written by the doyens of so-called punk music, from Patti Smith through to Sleater Kinney and everything in between. And that's just a fun book. And my premise there is that female musicians, women, are also grossly underrepresented in our literature and our critique. And now they're actually taking charge and they're writing their own versions of this important period in popular music history. So that's what I'm working on right now. and the World of Islam Festival and its musical comings and goings is there on my to-do list.
Well, I mean, that sounds like plenty to be getting on with, and I look forward to reading it when it comes along. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.